I, Michael R. Bloomberg, do solemnly swear.
On January 1st, 2002, when Michael Bloomberg was sworn into office, it was a very different world. iPods, Blackberries, pocket digital cameras, no one had them. And the city looked different. No Barclays Center, no Citi Field, and one World Trade Center was still a pile of rubble.
That I will faithfully discharge.
People smoked in restaurants, bars, and definitely clubs. Charter schools? Not so many. Biking, you'd see a few regulars and the daredevil bike messengers, but it was not yet a trending topic. There were no TVs in the back seats of yellow cabs as they crawled through the Times Square intersection of Broadway, and you needed cash. Back then, a market-rate one-bedroom apartment in Harlem was about $1,200 a month, about half of what it is today. Pizza was $1.50 a slice, same price as a Subway token. The High Line was a rusted, weedy, abandoned hulk of metal, not the setting for the cast of Girls before they headed home to Brooklyn. And oh yeah, Brooklyn wasn't the new Manhattan.
I can guarantee that New York is the best place in the world to do business.
And though he isn't responsible for all the change this city experienced, Michael Bloomberg leaves an indelibly large mark.
Thank you, and God bless New York.
You're listening to New York Remade, The Bloomberg Years from WNYC News. I'm Richard Hake. The first mayor of the 21st century influenced many facets of life. The physical landscape, housing, transportation, interactions with the police, how kids get into school, even what we eat, where we can smoke, and how we sort our trash. We begin at ground zero. 12 years ago, when Bloomberg was sworn in, that 16 acres was still smoldering. Now it hosts the tallest building in the Western Hemisphere. Bloomberg, unabashedly pro-development, rezoned 40% of the landmass in the city, and 7 of the 20 tallest skyscrapers would go up. WNYC's Matthew Sherman covered that rebuilding.
Any discussion of development under Mayor Bloomberg needs to begin almost 4 months before he took office. The September 11th attacks killed nearly 3,000 people.
Explosion! Oh my God!
And removed the city's two tallest buildings from the skyline.
We have been attacked. We have been tested.
10 million square feet of office space was lost in a matter of hours.
And now we are on the path to renewal and recovery.
In January 2002, Bloomberg outlined a long list of ventures to reinstate confidence in New York. It's not just Manhattan that's going vertical. New buildings constructed between 2000 and 2010 were taller, in terms of the number of floors, than those built during the previous decade in almost all city neighborhoods. That's according to NYU's Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy. Dan Doktoroff was Mayor Bloomberg's first deputy mayor of economic development. I meet him at his office at his new job. He's chief executive of the mayor's media company, Bloomberg LP, which, by the way, occupies one of those 7 tallest buildings constructed since 2002.
There was a call to make New York better, and in some ways even bigger than before. It was rebuilt.
Doktoroff has this idea.
The virtuous cycle of the successful city.
That idea led him and other city officials to rezone the city to encourage bigger buildings in neighborhoods they thought could handle more density.
You remember the old Gordon Gekko line from the movie Wall Street, greed is good? Well, for a city, growth is good because the marginal revenues from the additional resident, the additional visitor, the additional job produce additional revenues greater than the cost, which then can be reinvested, hopefully smartly, in quality of life.
In other words, a growing population produces more taxes, and those taxes can be used to make more parks, better schools, or better transportation, which in turn will attract even more people to come live here.
That really has been a big part of our philosophy over the last 12 years.
Bloomberg has rezoned 40% of the city's landmass. As a result, according to NYU's Furman Center, more than 300,000 more people will be able to live here. But increasing density has led to repeated clashes with residents of the neighborhoods being rezoned. One famous example, the Atlantic Yards project in Brooklyn, home of the new Barclays Center Arena.
This is the largest private sector project in Brooklyn's history.
In 2005, the mayor presided over the signing of a community benefits agreement. It promised affordable housing, affirmative action for local job applicants, and minority contracting goals.
We need jobs, we need opportunities.
That drew supporters to the project, but others balked at the sheer size of the proposal. 16 high-rises and a basketball arena on the edge of a neighborhood made up of 4- or 5-story brownstones.
Phase, at least 50% of the units constructed should be classified as affordable.
Tish James was the local city council member.
Project is too dense, and the height of the building should be reduced.
Normally, James would have played a starring role in negotiating with the developer, Bruce Ratner. She would have had a chance to bring down the proposed height of the buildings.
Stop the clock!
But the Bloomberg administration arranged for a state agency to review the project instead of putting it up for approval by the city council. And Tish James was sidelined. As it happens, aside from the basketball arena, very little of the project has been built so far. The 10-year timeline has been pushed back to something more like 25 years. And as a result, many of the jobs in affordable housing have also been delayed. Big real estate projects take so much time to come to fruition and go through so many unpredictable changes that Mayor Bloomberg's vision for the city will not fully come to fruition for 1, 2, maybe 3 decades. In other words, not just the next mayor, but the next several mayors will be operating in a landscape shaped by one of their predecessors, a denser, taller, more crowded city. The World Trade Center site is instructive. That's where I am now. For most of Bloomberg's first term and much of his second, it didn't look like anything was getting done here. But after Bloomberg and other officials intervened, rearranged responsibilities, and pumped more public money into the project, the Freedom Tower, now called One World Trade Center, is getting built. It's now taller than either of the Twin Towers ever were, the tallest building in North America.
WNYC's Matthew Sherman. As New York reached for the sky, people kept moving in. 1.5 million foreign-born immigrants. That doesn't include the influx of young people from all over this country, giving the city an all-time high population of 8,300,000. With more demand for housing, the city became less affordable. Cindy Rodriguez covers housing and poverty for WNYC. She tells this story of the mayor's efforts to create affordable housing.
There's a brand new 8-story building at 166th and Tintin Avenue in the Bronx that resembles a nice hotel with remarkable views.
The bridge is over there.
Les Bluestone is the developer. He ticks off the amenities. There's a new gym, even a glass-enclosed vegetable farm on the roof.
You've got basil and a variety of greens, bok choy.
But this isn't a nice condo. It's city-built, low-income housing. To live here, a couple with 2 kids can't earn more than $52,000 a year. This building is part of a promise the mayor made back in 2003.
We've begun a 5-year, $3 billion housing initiative.
The demand for affordable housing is overwhelming. 5,000 households applied for 124 units at this Bronx development, but it's a demand the mayor recognized early on, promising to create 165,000 units of affordable housing.
This will address one of the city's biggest problems, lack of affordable housing.
During that same speech, Bloomberg was also pledging to make the city a more desirable place to live.
We will continue to transform New York physically, giving it room to grow for the next century, to make it even more attractive to the world's most talented people.
It's a double-edged sword,
says Ingrid Gould Ellen, co-director of the Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy. She's standing on the Bowery, one of the most transformed areas in New York City.
Because the more people who want to live here, the more expensive it becomes.
And newcomers do keep coming. The city's population is at an all-time high. Take Jonathan Larson. He arrived from Seattle less than a year ago. Like many others his age, he headed straight to Brooklyn.
Yeah. So it's kind of the central room. There's like a hallway that goes that. There's 2 rooms down there, and then 3 rooms down here.
Larson pays $580 for this room that's roughly 100 square feet. It's what he can afford, and he had to go to the border of Bushwick and Bed-Stuy to find it.
I had to bring that in. Unfortunately, my room is the only one without a closet.
Each floor is full of young people. Larson came here to attend a creative writing program. The woman across the hall is training to be a merchandiser at Macy's. Larson says he was told by neighbors the building used to be what's called a three-quarter house.
Yeah, apparently all these higher buildings on the block were.
These are notorious places where landlords would cram as many people as possible into rooms, then collect a portion of their welfare payments. Many were fresh from prison and homeless shelters. Now, former three-quarter houses are where newcomers like Larson live. The Furman Center's Gould Ellen says the city is increasingly out of reach. In Bed-Stuy, for instance, median market rate rents went from $925 to roughly $1,400 between 2002 and 2011.
We've seen in the last 10 years, and especially recently during this recession, it's been particularly punishing. Rents have continued to go up, but incomes have fallen and poverty rates are increasing.
46% of New York families make less than $46,000 a year now, according to the city's own poverty measure. Gould Ellen does give Bloomberg credit for his commitment to affordable housing, but Furman Center data shows while he was creating units, more than 100,000 rent-regulated or subsidized apartments went market rate.
It is true that they're swimming upstream to some degree, or swimming against the tide of these sort of rushing market forces.
It's a paradox, Gould Ellen says. The more desirable the city, the more people come. The population is at an all-time high. So are rents. But Bloomberg is on schedule to complete his promise of either building or preserving 165,000 apartments.
Right, here we go. One, two, three. Yeah.
In 2007, he cut the ribbon for 10 new homes in East New York.
The big moment. This is the key to your new house.
Bloomberg touted his appreciation for the city's cultural, ethnic, and economic mix.
This is a place for rich and poor. This is a place for those who are just starting to struggle up the ladder, and we want those people who have been successful.
But for low-income New Yorkers who didn't get new keys, living in New York City can be tough. In the Bronx, Ricky Padin lives near 167th and the Grand Concourse. He says as a child, he practically grew up in New York City shelters. Now he pays $900 a month for a one-bedroom apartment he shares with a younger brother. Both young men work fast food jobs. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, food service has been one of the fastest-growing industries under Bloomberg. It also has the lowest wages. His apartment is meticulously organized. Padin had been working 70 to 80 hours a week at two different McDonald's.
I do everything, wash the dishes, take out the garbage, everything. I can't say what I don't do in there because I do the stock. That's the biggest thing.
He says he got fired from one location after he took part in an effort to protest the low wages of fast food workers. His rent takes up about three-quarters of what he earns each month, so he often eats at work or skips meals altogether. His brother helps out but can be inconsistent. Still, he feels lucky to have his own place and is determined to hold on to it.
A lot of people I work with live in shelters. You know, they live with friends. They live in a room. Or they live with family. But nobody's able to live alone.
The Bloomberg administration is proud of its record building well-designed, affordable housing and the effect it's had on neighborhoods. Housing Commissioner Matthew Wambua says its affordable housing developments are lifting up places like Morrisania in the South Bronx, once one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city.
If, in fact, rents are rising in a place like Morrisania, in many respects, that's a testament to success of massive investment.
Wambua adds cautiously, it's not as if the mayor brought the Bronx back to life.
But there was a time where the sense was you lived here at times as a default rather than as a choice.
Not too long ago, Harlem was one of those depressed neighborhoods. Right before Bloomberg took office, Carl and Ramona Scott paid just over $400,000 for their Harlem brownstone.
The prices now for this house probably would probably be in the neighborhood of maybe $1 million, or maybe more than that, maybe $1.5 million.
Property values rose in central Harlem 222% between 2000 and 2012. In nearby Morningside Heights, the increase was even greater. Scott is a retired school teacher, and his wife is a legal secretary. This solidly middle-class couple feels lucky to have reaped the rewards of their neighborhood gaining value.
Well, for me, it was great.
For those who timed it right, the Bloomberg years have been good. But for many others, Affording life in the city is getting harder.
WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez. You're listening to New York Remade, the Bloomberg Years. I'm Richard Hake. This mayor had a fierce commitment to expanding mass transit, fast buses, ferries, bike lanes, and subway lines, something that had not been seen for decades. But as WNYC transportation reporter Jim O'Grady found, while moving through the city got easier for some, rising housing costs pushed poor people farther away from the transit hubs.
The length of a commute, like so much else in New York, comes down to the cost of real estate.
Manhattan, it was pricey, and it's increasingly more pricey. So there wasn't anything in our price range, and we needed to find an affordable area.
That's Angela Tovar. She works for a community development group in Hunts Point in the Bronx. She lived on 12th Street near Avenue A from 2009 to 2011, when median rent in the Lower East Side was rising 10%. But her commute on a good day took only 35 minutes.
Typically what I would do is I would walk to Union Square and then just take the 405 Express to 125th Street. And then I would catch the 6 up to Hunts Point.
But 2 years ago, Tovar and her boyfriend found themselves priced out of Manhattan. Now her weekday mornings begin at the Jefferson Street stop of the L train in Bushwick.
That added probably another 20, 25 minutes to my commute every day.
During Bloomberg's 3 terms, it became especially expensive to rent or buy a home in Manhattan and the neighborhoods close to it. Over the last 10 years, most of the growth in commuting to well-paying jobs in Manhattan has occurred in Manhattan itself and in places like Williamsburg and Greenpoint, downtown and brownstone Brooklyn. From the beginning, the Bloomberg administration set about rezoning neighborhoods close to the Central Business District to allow for greater density, especially along the waterfront, which has seen a boom in luxury housing. Chris Leinberger, a former real estate developer now at the Brookings Institution.
We have a shortage of walkable urban land. There is pent-up demand for this stuff.
The mayor acknowledged the tension in his 2003 State of the City speech after praising what he called the city's hottest residential neighborhoods.
Argument, discussion, controversy. Naturally, this is New York. But who among us would want to live elsewhere?
Many former residents of these newly high-priced areas do live elsewhere after moving away in search of cheaper housing. They tend to land further from Manhattan in places with fewer transit options and longer commutes.
My name is Eddie Polanco. I'm 25 years old, and I grew up in Bushwick, Brooklyn, but I'm currently living in Staten Island, New York.
Around the time Angela Tovar was moving from the Lower East Side to Bushwick, Polanco's rent, also in Bushwick, jumped $200 a month. So he applied for public housing and wound up out in West Brighton on the north shore of Staten Island with his wife and 3-year-old son. But he still works in his old neighborhood for a party rental company.
Now I wake up at 4:30 in the morning to get ready in 20 minutes, and then I catch a 53 bus that takes me over the Verrazano Bridge into Bay Ridge.
Before Polanco moved to Staten Island, he bicycled to work. He says the trip took him 7 minutes.
14th Avenue, I take the L train to Morgan Avenue.
I'm exhausted just listening to that.
Joan Byron, policy director at the Pratt Center for Community Development.
Byron is studying changes to the commuting patterns of New Yorkers like Tovar and Polanco.
They're people who live in pretty dense neighborhoods within a couple of miles of the center of Manhattan, but who, because the transit system doesn't connect where they live to where they work, have heinously long commutes.
She lists transit-poor neighborhoods that have seen a recent influx of lower-wage workers.
East Elmhurst and Corona in Queens, East Flatbush, Canarsie, Flatlands in Brooklyn, Soundview in the Bronx.
Mitchell Moss, an NYU professor of urban planning and a former advisor to Mayor Bloomberg, argues that the economic growth that is driving up real estate hasn't displaced that many people.
No one was living on parts of Hunter's Point. No one was living in parts of Lower Manhattan. No one was certainly at all living in Dumbo. Those areas have become not gentrified, they've become populated.
But city planning maps show that displacement is real. For example, African Americans have been moving from the transit crossroads, that is Prospect Heights, where the median rent has gone up 20% since 2002, to parts of East Brooklyn that have barely any subway lines at all. And Hispanics have been moving from Upper Manhattan to cheaper neighborhoods in the South Bronx that are a long walk away from any subway. While this was happening, Bloomberg pushed to improve mass transit and extend its reach.
We should not stop until everybody has the opportunity to come into the central business district, go from one part of the city to the other on mass transit, because it is the future of our environment and it is the future of our economy.
In 2007, Bloomberg launched a campaign to bring congestion pricing to Manhattan, which he said would ease traffic jams while raising hundreds of millions of dollars for mass transit every year. That plan failed, but the mayor pushed ahead with other projects, such as extending the 7 train to the far west side of Manhattan. The project is being paid for with $2 billion in city funds. Ferries have gained a foothold, and biking is up. More than 45,000 New Yorkers now bicycle into the Manhattan core on weekdays. That's a big change for a city whose surface transportation policies formerly favored cars. The city's newest select bus route is in the Bronx, but it won't be going to Hunts Point, where Angela Tovar works. So for now, Tovar has resigned to her long commute between Bushwick and the South Bronx.
Spending 2 hours of your day on the subway is not ideal for anybody, but, you know, it's life and you make do with it and you buy a Kindle and you read a lot more.
It will be the next mayor's job to try and lower the number of New Yorkers who commute more than an hour each way to work. A problem Mayor Bloomberg, for all his success at adding transportation options to the city, couldn't solve.
WNYC's Jim O'Grady. When we come back, two areas where Bloomberg is globally recognized as an urban innovator, health and technology. You're listening to New York Remade, the Bloomberg Years, a WNYC News special. This is New York Remade, the Bloomberg Years from WNYC News. I'm Richard Hake. Watching a rerun of Sex and the City can send you back to what New York was like during Michael Bloomberg's first year in office. In the show, almost everyone smokes, and the trendy restaurants and bars are dense with fumes. WNYC's Fred Mogul says back in 2002, most people were concerned about dying at the hands of terrorists, not from cigarettes. Most people, but not Mayor Bloomberg.
At a hearing in late 2002, Bloomberg told the city council,
"The question before us is straightforward. Does your desire to smoke anywhere at any time trump the right of others to breathe clean air in the workplace?"
It was one of the few times Bloomberg ever testified on behalf of a bill. There were some protests, but the smoking ban passed by an overwhelming margin in the city council. Resentment festered.
That Bloomberg, I was so angry at him. If he was in the same room, I could have choked him.
That's 60-year-old Elizabeth Lane of Harlem.
I thought he was a dictator. I said, is this right? Can he really tell people what to do and how to do it?
Lane smoked for 40 years and tried many times to quit. In the end, it wasn't so much the smoking ban that got to her as the shocking ads featuring amputees, and especially the high tobacco taxes. At $12 a pack, Lane was dropping hundreds of dollars a month on cigarettes.
Which I couldn't afford. I had to beg, borrow, and steal to get money to buy cigarettes.
Finally, Lane says, family pressure and a lot of prayer moved her to dig out an old nicotine patch she'd gotten years earlier from a city-state giveaway program. And it worked.
I don't, when I'm walking, you know, that's improved. And I can walk upstairs, that's improved. And I don't cough, that's improved.
Quitting smoking has indefinitely postponed surgery to open her blood vessels and reduced her risk of cancer, stroke, and heart disease, potentially saving taxpayers tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And quitting smoking has also changed Lane's mind about Mayor Bloomberg.
He knew what he was doing. He did the right thing. And I'm thankful to him now.
Curtailing smoking has been Bloomberg's signature public health achievement. Other areas around the world have followed New York's lead, and local polls suggest the smoking ban remains hugely popular in the city. But the dramatic success on smoking has been difficult to replicate. On more widespread and complicated problems, progress has been more incremental, when there's been progress at all. Consider the city's most extensive and sustained public health campaign.
Obesity is a very bad thing.
Over the past 8 years, the Bloomberg administration has banned trans fats, required food establishments to post calories, encouraged green markets and produce carts, and started the country's first large-scale registry of individual diabetics. There's been some improvement among school children.
Overall obesity rates in K through 8, children ages 5 through 14, declined by 5.5% over the past 5 years.
But among adults, diabetes and obesity have increased. The initiative that garnered the most attention by far was attempting to limit the size of sodas and other sugary beverages.
Compared to smoking, this is an easy battle to win, and nobody's going to stop this, is my impression.
Not exactly. Bloomberg clearly touched a nerve. The mayor and his aides tried to argue that people could buy as much soda as they wanted, that the new rule would just reset the default size, forcing people to think a little bit before gulping down hundreds of calories. But opponents quickly got the label soda ban to stick, and they got help from the food industry.
So are we going to let the mayor tell us what size beverage to buy? If we let him get away with this, where will it end?
6 out of 10 New Yorkers oppose Bloomberg's sugary beverage initiative, according to a New York Times survey. 2 state courts so far have rejected the rule, not because the mayor couldn't create such a law, but because he tried to do so by bypassing the city council. Bloomberg biographer Joyce Pernick says the backlash might have had as much to do with Bloomberg fatigue as anything.
It was the third term, and here he was doing it again. So beyond the opposition of the beverage industry and beyond the concept of don't you tell me what to do with my body, I also think that it was enough already. You've done this too many times. I'm getting sick of you, and I'm getting sick of your policies. Leave me alone.
That report from WNYC's health reporter Fred Mogul. When it comes to tech, Bloomberg had a serious advantage coming in. He knew the value of information technology. His fortune was built on it. But New Tech City host Manoush Zomorodi says the story of the rise of the tech sector in New York might not have happened the way you think.
My name is @MikeBloomberg, and on behalf of all New Yorkers, it's a pleasure to welcome Twitter to New York City.
Good morning. We're at the headquarters of BuzzFeed, one of the world's most popular viral news sites.
Go to an opening for a tech company here, and chances are Mayor Bloomberg will be there with the scissors cutting the proverbial ribbon.
And if anybody doesn't know what a viral news site is, afterwards see me and I'll be happy to explain it.
The relationship between the city's techies and Mike Bloomberg can pretty much be summed up in one word: love fest. And when they think of the tech scene in New York without the mayor, well, many techies feel a little hole in their hearts. This is how Jake Schwartz, CEO of the startup General Assembly, puts it.
It's a scary thing to think that, you know, you had a tech entrepreneur in the mayor's office for 12 years, and all of a sudden we won't.
The mayor likes to take credit for transforming New York into the nation's #2 city for tech companies, and the founders of these companies are happy to let him.
New York has the most tech jobs of any city in the nation. They've grown here by some 30% since 2005. Our strategy, make our city the world's digital capital, is a big reason why.
But if you think turning tech into an economic engine is all because of Bloomberg, well, not quite. One of the key reasons the tech scene blossomed here is because one really smart guy just didn't want to live in Mountain View, Google's chief engineer Craig Neville Manning.
And they said, okay, let's do an experiment. You know, as we say a lot at Google, let's have you go out there, and if you can find more than 15 really great software engineers that we wouldn't have hired otherwise, you can stay.
In 2003, Neville Manning had to beg Google founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin to let him move back to New York and set up the company's first engineering outpost outside of Silicon Valley. Page and Brin indulged their top engineers' desire to return to the land of decent bagels because they didn't want to lose him or other talented engineers who just couldn't bear to live in California. At that time, memories of the dot-com bubble and bust of the late 90s lingered.
10 years ago, New York was a little bit in the dumps about technology. People really did view it not as a negative thing, but as something that we'd sort of tried in New York City and didn't really pan out.
And for the first half of Bloomberg's time in office, that was pretty much the status quo. When computer engineers moved to New York, it was usually because they loved the city, like Neville Manning, or because they'd been offered a job working for big bucks at a financial firm.
I wasn't one of those guys.
Mike Caprio fell into the first category. Now he's an engineer at a big tech company and organizes civic hackathons on the side. But when he moved here from Cape Cod in 2007, finding work wasn't easy.
I was just a software engineer. I wasn't, you know, a statistician or a big financial guy. I didn't know anything about
high volume, rapid transaction processing. I mean, that was always the first thing they asked me on an interview.
And so you weren't moving here because you were like, oh, New York's turning into a tech center. I got to be part of the action. That wasn't why you came here.
Definitely, definitely not. No, I came here mainly because I love New York.
A year after Mike arrived, Wall Street crashed. Instead of hiring, companies like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers went bust.
I can tell you the reckoning is coming for our city. We are going to have a smaller workforce and fewer services.
That's when the Bloomberg administration took lemons and made lemonade, says the Center for Urban Futures, Jonathan Bowles.
Lehman Brothers was really seminal in getting the Bloomberg administration to really embrace tech.
The administration began to shift its economic strategy. It had no choice.
I think that at that point, it became fundamentally clear that we couldn't rely on Wall Street to get us back.
Some of the highly skilled but now unemployed programmers and business people became entrepreneurs themselves. One big opportunity, the 2007 release of the iPhone. The lucrative application market that came out of it was dubbed the app economy. For others, a lower-paying job at one of the city's mid-sized tech companies like ZocDoc, Etsy, or Gilt was better than no job at all.
Log in, look around, and discover why Gilt has become my favorite place to shop.
And as these companies grew, investors saw potential. New York was the only major tech region in the U.S. to see an increase in venture capital deals between 2007 and 2011. The Bloomberg administration did its own investing too, putting over $3.5 million into tech incubators. But perhaps most significantly, it held a competition to create a new engineering university.
And today, after nearly 2 months of reviewing the proposals and interviewing the applicants, we are very excited to announce a winner.
The winner of the $100 million prize was ultimately Cornell. But smaller grants also boosted programs at the City University of New York, NYU, and Columbia. And according to the city, right now, around 1,000 startups are looking to hire for over 3,000 jobs. I asked Chief Engineer Craig Neville Manning if the mayor ever visits.
He did actually drop by for our 10th anniversary and cut a cake for us, which was fantastic.
In other words, the techies were glad the mayor dropped by their party. He made it an event, and he also brought a lovely bottle of First Growth Bordeaux.
WNYC's Manoush Zomorodi. This is New York Remade, the Bloomberg Years. I'm Richard Hake. Coming up, schools, garbage, and police. This is New York Remade, the Bloomberg Years, a WNYC News special. I'm Richard Hake. We turn now to three of the more controversial pieces of Bloomberg's legacy: education, garbage, and policing. The mayor's usual combination of data, budget acumen, and tough love met formidable foes here, producing some of the loudest and most prolonged battles. We begin with the city schools. WNYC's education reporter, Beth Fertig.
The data is not education. Data, data, data.
Diane Ravitch is an education historian and research professor at New York University. These days, she's been actively debunking Bloomberg's claims of school improvement. She says there's nothing inherently wrong with tests if teachers use them to figure out which students need more help.
But to use the test scores to close schools, to use them to award bonuses, distorts the purpose of the test. None of the tests now in use were designed for those purposes.
When Bloomberg first took office, he concentrated on reorganizing the school system. During his first two terms, scores went up on the state exams for elementary and middle school kids. But the state acknowledged its tests were too easy, and in 2010, it made them tougher to pass. Suddenly, the pass rates fell by double digits. This is why Ravitch thinks national tests are more reliable.
New York City's gains have not outpaced those of most other big cities. There are a few that haven't made any gains, and we're certainly ahead of Cleveland. So I don't see any big change there.
Big changes are easier to see on the high school level. When Bloomberg took office, the four-year graduation rate was less than 50%. Today, it's more than 60%. Raymond DeMonaco is director of education research at the New York City Independent Budget Office, which often differs with the mayor.
There is no doubt that the graduation rate in New York City went up. We looked at it with great scrutiny.
And that's where he says the focus on data did play a role with those A through F report cards. Schools that failed were replaced with small new schools that have had higher graduation rates on average.
The closure of large neighborhood high schools that had been failing for generations has contributed to the improvement in the graduation rate.
It also contributed to a lot of strife. In January of 2010, more than 1,000 people chanting "Save Our Schools" protested when a panel of mayoral appointees voted to close 19 struggling schools. Violet Hernandez was angry because her son was a student at one of them, the Metropolitan Corporate Academy High School in Brooklyn.
Let me tell you something. They said that that school is underperforming. That is not true. Whatever standard they're using to measure it, it's totally wrong. Kids that were failing are absolutely thriving.
In the past decade, more than 160 schools have closed or are in the process of closing, and four times as many new ones have opened. But Bloomberg's administration didn't just use student test scores to measure the schools. It also started using them to measure teachers. In 2011, Brooklyn Elementary teacher Linda Castagliola told us how angry she was to learn she was only average.
I don't look at their reading scores and say, oh, look, I'm a good teacher because everybody scored this. I know I'm a good teacher because I'm motivating my students. I'm motivating them to learn. I'm motivating them to be here. I'm motivating them to feel good about themselves.
How do we feel about testing?
This spring, a few dozen Brooklyn families staged a demonstration outside City Hall. 8-year-old Dove Alperin described how his third grade class spent too much time on test prep.
So instead of like just preparing for the test by pretending to take it, I think we should actually do more time learning.
But these days, schools and teachers are being held accountable for results. It started under the No Child Left Behind law, which required states to conduct annual tests in exchange for federal funding. Bloomberg just took it a step further. And when President Obama took office, his administration dangled billions of dollars worth of incentives to encourage more localities to do exactly what Bloomberg did.
Mayor Bloomberg, I want to thank you for your extraordinary courage in stepping up and taking control of the schools.
In February of 2009, the new education secretary, Arne Duncan, met with Bloomberg while visiting a Brooklyn charter school. He was promoting a new federal program to reward states that use exams and data systems to track the performance of students and teachers.
And I'm wondering your policy on that. Do you think that states...
I asked Duncan if so much focus on testing was really such a good idea. He was unequivocal in saying tests are necessary because the U.S. needs to raise its standards in this competitive global economy.
We should be able to look every second grader in the eye and say you're on track to being able to go to a good college or you're not.
And then Bloomberg weighed in on how that's part of the job of teaching.
They adjust, they customize their services to each student. If they don't know whether the student needs something, how can they do that?
Starting next year, test scores will count as part of the state's new teacher evaluation system. The state will also use some of the $700 million it won from the federal government to build a new data system, which means the systems Bloomberg put into place will still be around and required for his successor.
Reporter Beth Fertig. Bloomberg has been lauded around the world for focusing the city, and indeed cities everywhere, on climate change. Greenhouse and other emissions have gone down in New York, but one environmental issue has proved to be a tougher alligator to wrestle: garbage. Turns out, New York recycles far less of its waste than other major American cities. Amy Eddings explains.
It's garbage day on my block in Brooklyn. I'm making my contribution to the 11,000 tons of trash New York City's Department of Sanitation will handle today, part of the 14 million tons we generate each year. It's the kind of dirty essential work that operates under the radar most of the time. But it caught new Mayor Mike Bloomberg's Wall Street-trained eye in 2002 because he had a $7 billion budget gap to close.
We have gone from a world in sanitation where we used to dump the garbage on the landfill in Staten Island to a world where we are paying other cities to take our garbage. And that is an expensive proposition.
The sanitation department spending had grown from $600,000 in 1996 to more than $1 billion. It cost $105 a ton to truck our trash to a landfill somewhere else and bury it there. It was roughly half that amount when all the waste went to the city's own landfill at Fresh Kills. Mayor Bloomberg started developing a long-term strategy to stabilize these costs. In the short term, he cut recycling.
We have two recycling programs, one that works and one that does not. And we're going to propose closing the one that works temporarily until we can come up with a better solution.
Paper and metal recycling was making money for the city, but plastic and glass was not. Bloomberg said it had no value. A reluctant city council agreed to suspend plastic and glass recycling for 2 years. Former Staten Island councilman and congressman Michael McMahon chaired the Solid Waste Committee at the time.
What we were able to establish was that, no, actually the city's going to not only lose money by canceling recycling, but also hurt the program, wounding it, and that did happen, in fact, sadly.
The recycling rate, meaning the percentage of material kept out of landfills, was 20% before the cuts. In 2005, a year after they were restored, it was 16.8. It's never been higher than that. If you add the collection of old electronics, motor oil, and yard waste, New York City's overall recycling rate is about 27%. That's nothing compared to San Francisco at 77%, Los Angeles at 62%, and Seattle at 51%. If Mayor Bloomberg angered environmentalists by disrupting the recycling program, he made even more enemies when he unveiled his 20-year solid waste management plan, or SWAMP.
Okay, right here is where they will come off.
That's Upper East Sider Tony Ard in 2005, standing at the corner of York Avenue and East 91st Street. Mayor Bloomberg's SWAMP proposed converting four old marine waste transfer stations into high-tech facilities where garbage would be packed into containers and sent to landfills by barge and rail instead of truck. One of those reopened MTSs would be at East 91st Street.
Garbage dumps, and that's what this is. It's not a marine transfer station. It's a garbage dump. Garbage dumps shouldn't be in any residential neighborhood where people live, where there are parks where people play.
It was an argument that fell flat for Staten Islanders who bore the stigma of Fresh Kills for more than 50 years. It also didn't sit well with Black and Latino New Yorkers, whose neighborhoods have long hosted bus depots and sewage plants, the stuff that nobody likes but everybody needs. Eddie Bautista, head of the Organization of Waterfront Neighborhoods, said the SWAMP would bring environmental justice.
There isn't a single waste transfer station in Manhattan, yet it generates over 40% of the city's waste. There's something wrong with this picture, and we're asking for justice. This is a civil rights problem more than anything else.
Bloomberg's SWAMP proposed that every borough would have to host some kind of garbage facility. Borough equity is a fair and noble idea, but it felt misguided and punitive to Upper East Siders. Their opposition dominated the debate, as Councilman McMahon found out at a 2005 hearing when he asked East 91st Street opponents to raise their hands.
How many people here are willing, are going to march and protest and do everything within their means to stop it? How many people here are going to endorse and bring into court if necessary, litigation to stop the whole plan and litigate the matter? Clearly, 80 to 90% of the people here raised their hand on
every question. He asked Sanitation Commissioner John Doherty if he would look at alternate sites.
Are we looking to get it done, or are we looking to just kind of stall it and look and look and look and look? I mean, looking takes a long time. You know, we all know. I see it when I go to site a garage someplace, never mind a transfer station. As soon as you pick the neighborhood, the banners come up. Go someplace else, please. You know, so it is a
the banners went up at East 91st and have not come down. The SWAMP has become a swamp, mired in litigation and politics.
The true answer to this issue is to work hard to increase that diversion and recycling rate.
Deputy Mayor Kaz Holloway.
Because it is by lessening the amount of waste that New Yorkers produce overall that you will make all of these facilities less burdensome and then, who knows, ultimately maybe obsolete.
Ah, yes. Recycling. That program that wasn't working when Bloomberg took office. He leaves having announced a number of initiatives, including an expansion of the recycling program to include more types of plastic and pilot food composting programs. And Mayor Bloomberg helped cut the ribbon last week on a new $110 million state-of-the-art recycling sorting facility in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. It was built by Sims Metal Management. Its director of municipal recycling, Tom Outerbridge, gave me a tour.
So there's the tipping building. Barges in there, trucks in here. So, and here's the processing system.
Wow, look at this. Yeah, this holy cow. Crazy. It's amazing.
I'm looking at a huge green mechanical monster, a sprawling network of conveyor belts, magnets, screens, and optical sensors that will sort down the materials into their separate types and colors. This will make it more valuable. New York City will get a share of the revenue. It's the fix to the recycling program that Mayor Bloomberg promised in 2002.
Amy Eddings. Perhaps nowhere can the Bloomberg administration's success be more easily understood than in fighting crime. This year, the homicide rate is expected to fall below 400, a fifth of what it was 20 years ago. But one of the tools used to fight crime is stop, question, and frisk, a technique all too familiar to the city's young Black and Latino men. At one point, the number of stop and frisks exceeded the number of African-American men living in the city. The lasting outcry to this controversial law enforcement tactic may threaten Bloomberg's crime legacy. Here's WNYC's Kathleen Horan.
When Mayor Mike Bloomberg took office, he made a point of setting a tone of inclusiveness.
I just only have a couple of words. One, Reverend Shockman, thank you for inviting me. Pleased to come.
In 2002, right after his inauguration, Bloomberg addressed Sharpton's National Action Network. That was something Rudy Giuliani refused to do.
I would hope that you invite me for each of the 4 years that the voters of the city of New York have given me, and I'll be pleased to come every time.
The applause lasted for quite a while. Bloomberg's choice for police commissioner, Ray Kelly, made civil libertarians hopeful. Chris Dunn is associate legal director with the NYCLU.
Commissioner Kelly came in having taken public positions before his most recent tenure against abusive police practices, including stop and frisk. He had been vocal in talking about the importance of community relations and community policing.
During Bloomberg's first term, racial tensions eased. Crime continued to plummet. But in his second term as police commissioner, Kelly's approach was more aggressive. Quietly, he was ramping up the stop, question, and frisk tactic. From about 97,000 stops in 2002 to more than 506,000 just 4 years later. In high-crime neighborhoods, people were beginning to share their experiences. 63-year-old Gloria Freeman is a lifelong resident of Bedford-Stuyvesant. She described a stop she witnessed where three youths, no older than 14, were detained.
They were just playing. The cops pulled them over and knocked them against this wall right here where I'm sitting. And that wasn't necessary. The kids didn't, you know, do anything. They were playing among themselves, and they just frisked them and knocked them against. And then they put them in the car. And, you know, all the kids are not bad.
In 2007, complaints about stops with the Civilian Complaint Review Board climbed to a peak of over 2,500. But for a wide swath of New Yorkers, it was off the radar. 2 years later, Bloomberg won a third term in office.
I'm 69 years old. I've lived in New York City all my life. And policing has never been a mainstream political issue.
That's Robert Ganji, who heads a group called the Police Reform Organizing Project. After it was created in 2011, they worked with other like-minded groups to form a movement against abusive policing tactics. He says one of their main goals was to make stop and frisk a top-tier political issue.
I had more than one conversation with people I would call politically astute, and when I told them that was a principal goal, they looked at me as if I had announced plans to put on a cape, go up to the roof of the building, and try to fly.
But the numbers continued to rise, and the media began to take note.
Then he went into my front right pocket. Then he went to my front left pocket.
In 2011, Leo Henning and Hassan Covington spoke to WNYC's Elsa Chang about being stopped and searched by police.
He stuck his hands in. His fingers was going under my foot, inside my sock. That's when he felt it together.
Did he ever ask if he could search you?
No.
The following year, new data came out showing that the police made about 685,000 stops in 2011, a new all-time high. The NYCLU's Chris Dunn.
There had been more young Black men stopped than there were young Black men in the entire city population.
Close to 90% were never charged. It seems like stop and frisk has been with us forever. but it's only been a front-burner political issue for about a year. At a silent march against Stop and Frisk that June 2012, several thousand demonstrators lined Fifth Avenue holding signs like, "Color is not reasonable suspicion." Three mayoral candidates were among them, Christine Quinn, William Thompson, and Bill de Blasio. It was a signal that opposition was becoming politically potent. That month, Mayor Bloomberg visited a pair of black churches in Brooklyn, including First Baptist Full Gospel Church of Brownsville. He promised more oversight of Stop and Frisk. For the first time, he acknowledged problems.
And to borrow a phrase from President Clinton, I believe the practice needs to be mended, not ended, to ensure that stops are conducted appropriately with as much courtesy as possible.
Mend it, not end it. Mayor Bloomberg has not repeated the statement since. Parishioner Helen Wilson heard the mayor give his speech.
Being mended, it would be a good thing. When they stop them on the street for no reason and push them up against the wall, I think that's not a good thing.
Wilson's grandson, lanky 16-year-old Kasim Robinson, knows about that. He says the last time he was stopped, he was waiting for a friend after school.
It was like a shocking moment because like I didn't know what I got stopped for. So when they had stopped me, it was just like I was shocked. I didn't know what to say.
Earlier this year, Judge Shira Shinlin began to hear testimony in a federal class action suit against Stop and Frisk. In a speech at police headquarters within spitting distance of the courthouse, Mayor Bloomberg rebutted critics who suggest the tactic doesn't recover enough guns.
Wrong. That's the reason we need it, to deter people from carrying guns. We are the first preventers. The special interest groups who know nothing about policing and some elected officials who've never had responsibility for public safety strategies are putting ideology and election year politics above public safety.
In June, he became more explicit. He said Stop and Frisk didn't target a particular ethnic group.
It's not a disproportionate percentage of those who witnesses and victims describe as committing the murder. In that case, incidentally, I think we disproportionately stop whites too much and minorities too little.
Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute says Bloomberg and Kelly will be remembered for one of the most sustained drops in crime in the city's history. But she says the mayor would have served himself if he invited residents who had benefited from the drop in crime to make that case.
I would have liked to have seen more of the law-abiding, especially the elderly, presented and say it's these people who we are responding to in determining our deployment decisions.
Commissioner Kelly did just that a few months ago in Bedford-Stuyvesant when he attended an annual neighborhood event supporting the group Grandmother's Love Over Violence. Kelly has cultivated an ongoing relationship through a monthly breakfast with the women for the past 2 years.
We shall not be afraid.
Some of the members say they've asked the commissioner about the disrespectful way some stops are conducted, including 56-year-old Denise Peace. But after what she's lived through, he says she supports just about any effort by the police to curb shootings.
I lost 3 of my children in gun violence. 3. So I'm here just, they support me and I support them. I don't have nobody to frisk anymore.
Murders in Brooklyn have dropped below 150, another record low. Commissioner Kelly.
What does it translate to? It translates into lives saved. It translates into mostly young lives saved. It's mostly young males. Lives saved, because that's who, for the most part, is being shot on the streets of our city.
Bloomberg and Kelly do receive high marks in many parts of the city. Tribeca's 40-something-year-old Alicia Ngaro says as a lifelong New Yorker, she's very pleased with how much the crime rate has dropped, and she supports Stop and Frisk.
I'm for safety, so I just feel like, you know, yeah, go ahead, check. If there's something to check, if our city's in danger, if our citizens are in danger, I'm in favor.
In August, Judge Shira Shinlin found the NYPD has been violating the Constitution. In her decision, she wrote, "The city's highest officials have turned a blind eye to evidence that officers have conducted stops in a discriminatory manner." She added, "In their zeal to defend a policy they believe to be effective, they have willfully ignored overwhelming proof." The city is appealing, and the city is on track to fall below last year's record low number of homicides.
Kathleen Horan. Looking back on history, the mayors with strong personalities like Fiorello LaGuardia, Ed Koch, and Rudolph Giuliani are remembered because they became the face and voice of the city. They were quintessential New Yorkers. That's something that doesn't change. Now, Michael Bloomberg joins one more exclusive club. His persona is etched in our collective memory. He's condescending.
What do you want me to say? Whether or not it's appropriate behavior? What on earth could the question be?
He's stubborn.
Nobody's banning anything. And that's why sometimes the polls are very misleading. Because you ask the question, how do you like a ban on sodas? We're not banning anything.
He cares.
There's no ways to explain to a parent why it's their child that is picked. But sadly, we've lost one of our finest. Somebody who was out there trying to protect the rest of us, doing his duty that we've asked him to do.
He's mysterious.
The mayor has to be able to have a private life and not disclose where he is. We've set a policy day one.
He's passionate.
I've got to defend my children and you and everybody else and do what's right to save lives. Obesity kills.
When Staten Island Chuck, the city's groundhog, bites him, he forgives.
The only thing that stood between Chuck and you getting bitten was my finger. And I have a scar to prove exactly how much I love one of the five best boroughs we have.
He's determined.
Los trabajadores de la ciudad están limpiando las calles de esta tormenta de nieve.
When appearing on stage with Lady Gaga, he flirts.
It was fun. And it would be remiss if I didn't also add to that that the best kiss of the night came after that from Diana.
He also gets emotional when talking about his legacy in New York City.
That is my heartfelt hope. That is my wish for the future. And that is what I want more than anything else for my little grandson and all the generations to come. Thank you. God bless our great city.
This has been a WNYC News special. New York Remade, The Bloomberg Years was edited and produced by Andrea Bernstein. The technical director is George Wellington. You can find much more online on our New York Remade page at WNYC.org. It has maps, charts, and some cool photos. I'm Richard Hake for WNYC News.